Jeff Merrick, I want to let you know something off the top of the podcast here.
Sure, what's up?
I have decided to do this podcast today sans visor.
What? What are you thinking? Think of the children. What's wrong with you? Think of the example you're setting. You idiot.
He's well, it's a personal. It's a personal
stupid head.
Personal choice. Personal
no.
Really.
Only but. I may claim moral superiority because what I like to do, Greg Wyshynski, is I like to live out my conscience on the internet and then go back to doing nothing about the sport that I love.
Oh.
That seems to be the debate about visors. Yes.
Wow. You think so?
I am the person I want everyone to believe that I really am on the internet, and then I'll just go back to enjoying the sport, which is what a lot of people do when it comes to not just issues like visors, but also violence in the game of hockey. That's why I always sort of snicker at the high and mighty that tweet high and mighty things.
Issues of player issues of player safety, as it were.
What are these players stupid? What's wrong with them? They all wear helmets. Why shouldn't they wear visors too?
Indeed. Hey, by the way, if you're listening to the podcast, tell a friend that the URL for the podcast has been updated. We're getting a lot of people that are chiming in early and saying, over type new URL for podcast, because Sportsnet is changing its it changed its website a little bit, right?
It's changed. Yeah, it's changed. So there is a new URL.
Okay. So I'm sending out the bat signal. I put it on the blog today, but evidently,
hang on, let me send it.
See it, podcast, boom. All right, there we go. Back to visors. Well, of course, we're talking about this because last night Mark Stahl took a deflected puck off the eyeball and dropped to the ice in terrible pain.
Yeah.
It was a scene that we've seen before countless times in the National Hockey League. Skates off, bloodied, all sorts of swelling and stuff. The eye injury evidently not career threatening from what we hear. But a nasty scene, and a nasty scene that then becomes a point of political debate because Mark Stahl does not wear a visor.
Yep.
But that
is
his choice.
Oh, I know, and it is his choice. And for my money, see, I always, in situations like this, I'll always defer to what the players think, specifically now about visors, because I think the day's wish of, oh, you're just a coward if you wear a visor, oh, you're a wimp if you wear a visor, oh, only European, you know, chicken-ass players only wear visors. Like, we're past that. And the majority of players in the NHL wear visors. So I don't think it's a peer pressure thing why guys don't wear visors, even ones that wear full cages in Division I and quarter visors in the Canadian Hockey League. So I think we're past that. Honestly, if you ask a lot of players, they want to keep it. They would like to keep it player choice because some players just don't feel ready for it. And I believe this. They say they just don't feel safe.
Thank you.
Wearing a visor. They don't.
That was the point. That was the point I was going to make.
Your eyesight is not for everybody, but for some people's vision, it does seem compromised. And if I'm a player in the NHL going 35 miles an hour out there with pucks flying around and bodies flying around and elbows and high sticks flying around, I would like to be able to see everything as much as possible, even if it means putting my eyes in harm's way. That's the deal the players make when they don't wear a visor. And I understand that.
It's a twofold issue. It's a twofold issue from the players that I've talked to off the record about this visor stuff. The first thing is obviously their own safety, which I've heard from a number of veteran players that some of whom have tried to play with a visor.
Matt Sundin is the perfect example. He put one on and said, I can't do it. I can't. I see when I'm just going, you know, barefaced, I can see everything, I can follow everything, and I feel safe out there. When I put the visor on, there's a separation now between my eyeballs and the puck, and I don't feel safe out there. That's the perfect example.
But the other thing, and this is something I've heard from players as well, and it's not necessarily like what you want to hear when it comes to a debate of over, you know, are you going to go blind playing the sport you love? But they don't like the National Hockey League telling them what to do. That's part of it, too. The part of it is also we don't want the NHL to make decisions for us vis-a-vis the equipment that we wear, player safety, this sort of thing. And there's a hesitance, at least amongst some of the veteran players that I've talked to allow the NHL to do that.
Yeah, I can understand that, too.
Political.
I can understand that, too. But more so than ever, I think it's a safety issue for them, i.e. they don't feel safe wearing a visor. Like, if you look out of the corner of your eye and your sight is compromised, you feel like you're vulnerable out there, and you could be, right? And you just very well may be. Like, sports is, I always raise this example. Let me think about this. Think about this one. I always raise this example. You know, everyone's so quick to make rules for sports. You know, mandatory this, and you got to wear that, and it's player safety, and you got to wear this type of protection. How come nobody says things like this? If you go to Wall Street, if you go to Bay Street in Canada, there are some people that work, you know, 80 hours a week. They just pound it. They make personal sacrifices to the detriment of their health, jacking themselves up with amphetamines so they can work harder and longer than the next guy or girl beside him or her in order to get ahead. No one says we have to limit how much this person has to work. It's their choice to make that sacrifice and put themselves in harm's way to do better for themselves and do better for their families. Why do we have a different standard for sports?
I don't know.
Why is it different? Why is it different?
That's a good point.
All of a sudden, you know why? It goes back to my original point. People like to live out their conscience on the internet, say things that make them feel good about how they feel they are being presented online, and then they go back to just consuming the sport that they love and do nothing about it. I've said my piece on the internet. I think visors should be mandatory. These players are idiots. If it's good enough for Jerome Iginla, it should be good enough for everyone in the National Hockey League. There, now I'm going to go back and watch hockey.
Well, that's why I keep it real on Twitter and keep it real on the blog. You know, I like fighting.
You know?
I freely admit that there's an enormous, gigantic, Wellwoodian, Buffalinian elephant in the room when it comes to being a guy who's concerned about concussions and also enjoys fighting. And that's why I'm honest about both, which is I think that the concussion issue is sometimes overwrought, and I like fighting. So there you go. So I spell it out there. I practice what I preach. I watch the sport. Yeah. Paint me as a Neanderthalic imbecile, but I'm not going to say, oh, the poor brains of the National Hockey League player. Ooh, fight.
Yeah. You know what, though, at the same time as well, I find this with many fans and people within the game as well. This idea that the NHL has to have a safe game. You never want to see anyone get hurt out there. I'd be willing to argue that you do. I'd be willing to argue that part of the attraction of this contact sport is the danger. And unless there are injuries, there's no such thing as danger. If everyone's safe, this is not a dangerous thing anymore. Part of the appeal of hockey is that players are going to get hurt. They will. And I would argue that many, if not every person that watches hockey, and be honest with yourself listening right now, this is part of the attraction for you. The violence and the injury. Now, not to say this should be, you know, rollerball for crying out loud. Medieval type sport. But there is a fine line between trying to keep it as safe as possible, but still allowing for a certain level of violence. And yes, folks, the reality that injuries are what keeps this sport dangerous, and whether you care to admit it or not, part of the attraction of this sport for you, correct me if I'm wrong here, Wish, is the danger, is the risk that these players put themselves. That's why I never disparage anybody for earning a single dime in this game. To me, nobody's overpaid when you consider what they do.
How dare you claim that hockey fans watch it for the crashes? which is the old harangue about NASCAR. But you're right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. There is that element of it. Now, I don't necessarily think I go to a game hoping that a deflected puck hits a defenseman in the eye. But level of unpredictability about at any moment in the game, something crazy, be it injurious, be it offensive, be it whatever, could happen, is clearly part of the appeal of professional hockey. I completely agree with you on that.
Here's the hypocrisy that everybody has. And I guess I would count myself, as one of them. But at least I'm honest to myself about this. Nobody wants to see injuries, but everybody wants a dangerous game. No one wants to see injuries, but everybody wants a rough game. Do you see how those two are not in concert, folks? Like, whenever I hear anyone say, oh, you never want to see anyone get hurt out there. Oh, you know, the terrible, there's awful injuries. Hang on, do you think for a second that the NHL wants this game to be safe? And do you think fans really want this game to be safe? The answer is no.
I'd go one step further and say this about hockey fans. And this might be a gigantic generality. This might be applying my own psychoses onto the masses. But I would proffer that hockey fans don't want to see severe injuries, but want a dangerous game. I think hockey fans kind of like injuries in some cases.
Yeah.
That moment of chaos when a player is down on the ice and he's hurt, and then the teammates all rush over and it becomes a big schmoz. You know, a little blood here and there never hurts.
Yeah. I
would proffer that we don't want to see stretchers. And when we see stretchers, what happens? Then everybody clutches the pearls and throws the book at somebody, right? So we don't want to see stretchers, and we don't want to see blind guys, but we do want to see little pools of blood on the ice from sticks. We do want to see injuries that make someone stay on the ice for a little bit, and then there's a big moment of retaliation and chaos, and there's a little fight. So I would say we don't want to see severe injuries, but we do like to see injuries, and we do like a dangerous game.
But don't you think at the same time that if you want a game of hockey that involves, you know, body contact and violence and, to your point, you know, that chaotic nature of it, that you have to expect that every now and then there's going to be a horrible injury in this game. Every year there's going to be something that makes you go, oh man, I can't watch that. Oh my God, did you just see what happened? Hey, what, 2 weeks ago we thought Artem Anisimov was never going to move, let alone walk again, never be able to like move his fingers. Like we thought he was going to be like numb from the neck down. You see that shootout goal he scored yesterday, bro?
Uh-huh.
You see Artem Anisimov, like what, did he go to Lourdes and get miraculously healed and then come back? And did you see him go down on that shootout goal yesterday? It was miraculous. But there was that moment on the Kyle Quincy play a couple of weeks ago against the Detroit Red Wings. We said to ourselves, to your point about stretchers, that's something we never want to see. But as a hockey fan, don't you have to say to yourself, there is an expectation that given the nature of this game, we are going to see stretchers.
Yes. Yes. We don't want to, but yes. Visor debate, where are we right now? I would tell you exactly where we are right now. The National Hockey League, Bill Daly to be exact, emails the New York Times. New York Times writing about a player safety issue. Well, that's rare. The league continues to support a rule that would make visors mandatory in National Hockey League games, said Daly.
Yep.
As you know, it has been the consistent position of the Players Association that they are opposed to mandating visor use, that it should be a matter of player choice, and that the increased visor use by players should be achieved through continued education and sensitization. I don't know what the hell is that. So the dangers associated with non-use, I believe, that continues to be the Players Association position, although I cannot speak for them. Well, here's what the Players Association says. Via Katie Strang of ESPN, Matthew Schneider said the NHLPA supports individual choice on visor issue but continues to educate players on benefits of wearing one. Plan is for the NHLPA to further discuss visor issues and other equipment-related matters at player meetings this summer. Which is, you know, I'm sure they discuss the visor issue every summer. So, once again, NHL says, we're down with mandatory visors if only the Players Association would be down with us. And the Players Association says, well, we're going to leave it up to the players.
Here's the thing. Don't you see the NHL already evolving to a place where pretty much everybody's going to wear visors? I think it's about 65% of the league wear visors now.
Uh-huh.
And every year when a new crop comes in, generally the guys are wearing visors. I mean, it's just evolving that way anyhow. Why does everything have to have – why do you have to hit the fast-forward button on everything?
Mm-hmm.
Why just sort of artificially, boom, right away, got to be mandatory visors. Mm-hmm. Sorry if you can't deal with it. No room for you here. It's evolving that way. You can't leave anything time to evolve into something. It's got to be hurry up offense. Boom, got to change it right away.
That said, sometimes you need to tell people to do something for their own benefit because they're too macho to do it or they're too stubborn to do it.
The macho thing is gone.
You think so?
I think the macho thing is gone. You know, players like Jerome McGinley, he may be the touchstone for all of us. One of the, you know, pound for pound, toughest players in the last generation. Dude wears a visor, all right? Like, I think the macho thing is done. That's what I was saying off the top. Like, I think the era of, oh, you know, you're a chicken ass if you wear a visor. Oh, you can't, oh, look at this. Oh, visor. Oh, take off your windshield. Oh, do you have a wiper on that thing? You know, let me get you some windshield washer for your visor, pretty boy. That day's done. Right? That day is done in the National Hockey League. The days of, you know, haranguing someone for wearing a visor, that's finished. That is completely done.
Mm.
I don't buy that it's a macho thing. Oh, guys want to be tough. No, they don't. Most players wear visors already.
Last thing on this I'll say, and I agree with this sentiment that's being put out there by some of the listeners. By the way, the question of the day is, should visors be mandatory in the National Hockey League? PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com, at Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick, hashtag at NVSW. Grandfathering them in is the best solution, and allowing the players that generally feel that they cannot switch to visors at this point in their careers or what have you, treat it like the helmet issue. treat it like the helmet issue where you grandfather in the non-helmet guys, and then eventually everybody's wearing a helmet. I mean, that to me is that is the most logical way to do it and the best way to do it.
No player put on a helmet and said, I feel as if my safety is in jeopardy. It was more just a comfort thing. This isn't about comfort. This is about safety and being able to see things and being able to see the entire ice. So I always find it fraudulent when people compare it to the helmet issue.
Oh, I don't at all, because it comes back to the same thing I said before, which is that you don't want – these players don't want the National Hockey League telling them what to do. They don't want them telling them how much money they should make. They don't want them telling them when the season should start based on a lockout. They don't want them telling them anything. That's the whole point. The point is that sometimes these guys are stubborn to the point where they're not going to do what should be done because they don't want the NHL to be the one telling them to do it. They want to believe. So the trick is, America, what I'm trying to say is the trick is to trick them like a child into believing that they are the ones making a decision. But at the end of the day, it's the decision being made by the National Hockey League.
But isn't that part of the problem? Whether it's media, whether it's executives, all treat these athletes like they are children. Like who do you think has... You know, more skin in the game as far as, you know, making a decision on what should happen on the ice. Like, sure, these guys aren't Rhodes Scholars. None of these guys have, you know, carry PhDs with them. But if you talk to a player like Steven Stamkos, you know, about the game itself or about player safety, who do you think's opinion should resonate more? A guy like me or a guy like him? Like, he understands the game. I always find it, you know, hilarious and borderline offensive when people who, and I don't play this authenticity card very often, but there are just some people that are more believable in certain circumstances, guys that haven't played hockey at the NHL level, their argument to me about what a player should wear, to me, comes up a little bit short when the argument goes, who are you going to believe? I'll take the guy that plays in the NHL. I'll listen to that guy as opposed to someone who hasn't, you know, gone on the ice at the NHL level. I'm more willing to listen to what he has. Why do we disqualify what players think? Oh, little. Why do we treat them like children? They're grown men who are making decisions for their career.
The premise of your argument is nonsensical because you're acting as if there's some sort of across-the-board draconian rule that the NHL would pass without the NHLPA's input. Of course, it's going to work together on this thing, but there's no question that it's the Players Association that's dragging its feet, and it's the reason. And them dragging their feet is the reason why Mark Stahl took a puck in the eye.
No, it's
because no one told Mark Stahl to put on a visor last night.
Dragging their feet?
Totally.
So you think this is just a matter of this is eventually going to happen? So
I think it should happen. I think it happens in every. Why is there eye protection at every other level of hockey except for the National Hockey League? Why?
Because that's where you turn professional. Although there is a mandatory visor in the American Hockey League, but that's
it's not so much a macho thing. It's the I'm a professional now and I don't have to wear eye protection. Eye protection is for amateurs and children.
Listen to my point. My point is that for these guys, it is a player safety thing because they would like to be able to see as best as they can. Now, some guys can wear visors and it's not a problem. Some guys wear visors and it's cool. Hey, I can see fine with this visor. I feel safe out there. Other guys can't. No two hockey players are exactly the same. That's why I'll still support their right to choose to either wear a visor or not. Now, they can't complain when they get hit in the face. They can't feign surprise when they get hit in the face by a puck. That to me comes up a little bit fraudulent. But I'll still say, you know what? If they feel that they can't perform at their best, and that's why owners are kind of weird on this one too. On the one hand, they pay the insurance for all the players. But on the other hand, they want their players to have the best possible equipment in order to perform at the very top level so that they can, you know, advance in the playoffs, and earn more money for the franchise. So they're sort of, Their allegiance is split. One, they pay the insurance and they'd like to have the players wear visors. But if by and large, player X, Y, and Z says, I can't wear a visor because I don't feel safe out there and I can't perform at my top level, then I think the owner says, all right, take the visor off. But don't complain about it if you get hurt. I don't think Mark Stahl can come back and complain about not having a visor.
I get the last word because I'm from New Jersey. There's also many, many cases of a guy taking a puck in practice or taking a puck during the game and then coming back and wearing a visor. So they have their Ebenezer Scrooge moment. They were visited by the ghost of blinding pucks to the eye, past, future, and present, and then they come back and put a visor on after they took a puck to the eye.
Yeah, and some guys go their entire career and don't take a puck in the eye.
Yeah, well, those
it's
guys
not as if this
are
is
obviously
epidemic, right?
Not giving their all for the team. They're off cherry-picking
well,
pucks instead of blocking
I'll tell you
them.
What, this This is one of the reasons. Remember when the NHL was proposing bigger nets and they wanted, because every goaltender was, you know, using the butterfly right now. So I think it was Larry Quinn, ex of the Buffalo Sabres, who proposed this. Remember those nets that were higher and wider on top?
Yeah, the idea was it looked like parentheses.
It looked like it. So it's like, okay, if the goaltenders are going down, we're going to give shooters more room up top to shoot. My initial thought was, and I'm sure someone brought this up as a way of saying, are we insane? Why are we making nets higher? Isn't the last thing you want to do is to encourage players to shoot higher when you consider all the faces that are standing right there? That should be like the last thing the NHL does. That's always been my argument against bigger nets. If you want to make them a little bit wider, okay. But bigger as far as height goes, I don't think we should be doing anything that encourages players to shoot higher up around the throat, the eyes, and the head.
And my reaction to that was also, are you insane? Don't you people know it's not about goals? It's about offensive flow. That's the important thing about this game. I'm telling you, Merrick, I would go 4-on-4. I'd go 4-on-4 before I'd go to soccer size, lacrosse size nets in this game. You know that?
Well, if you want to talk about player pushback, try taking a player off the ice. Try taking a job off the ice. Never mind visors. You're taking someone out of the game. You're taking players out of the lineup. You think you got to push back on, you know, little iTech Oakley Bauer visors now? Or you start taking players off the ice?
And that's the play. That's the play.
Okay, so we've decided that we want better offensive flow, so we're going to make it 4-on-4 all the time. What say you, Donald Fear?
You'll never tell a losing job.
Okay, how about this? We'll go back to 5-on-5 if all of your players decide to wear visors.
Okay, fine. Wear visors.
That's what you do. That's the strategy.
That's negotiation.
You overshoot and then come back.
Could you imagine if they just invited me in the room for me to do my Bettman impression, we could have ended the lockout in a matter of 3 days. 3 days, based on my incredible negotiating skills. All right. Luke Robitaille, the Los Angeles Kings, coming up in a second. And also Jeff and Greg go postal today. Load up the queue with your questions, hockey-related or otherwise. I have a feeling we may take a query or two about a certain person who passed to the other side.
Oh, yes.
All right, we'll get to that later in the show. But first, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Are you familiar with the game called hockey?
All I have to do is talk for a living.
You say lube 10 times, you just feel better.
You say lube 10 times, you're going to feel better.
Why shouldn't I always be happy? I'm stealing money.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I went through life with this last name, okay?
I'm a kindly old wizard.
Close your eyes, hold your nose, swallow the medicine.
Debate hockey.
Swift Current Broncos. Las Vegas Hurricanes. The Vancouver Giants.
God.
Pop culture.
I don't want to be culturally insensitive. I never am on this show, so we still may have Twinkies here in the States.
Some may have the ho-ho. Good news,
might have the ding-dong.
And more hockey.
Jeff Merrick on the top. Snucking the biscuit around.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Let's start the show proper, shall we?
Mark Pargas writes in about visors. No mandatory visors, Mark says. As long as players don't wear their helmets the way that they did in Pee Wee's, on tight because mom and dad strapped them on, visors will not provide the right amount of protection that proponents say they will. Many of the players who use visors wear their helmets in a way, cocked back so the visor looks more like Brooks Robinson's short-bill batting helmet that greatly reduces the amount of protection the plastic can provide. So it doesn't matter if you tell them to wear a visor as long as they're not wearing their helmet correctly.
As long as their buckets on too loose,
it's not going
to
matter.
They used to do that in junior hockey in Canada when visors were made mandatory. What they do is they tilt back their helmet. So essentially your visor was protecting your forehead. So you still had the eyes. So you could still see the entire ice. And then finally the CHL said, okay, dum-dums, you're bringing the visor right down here and it better cover up your eyes. So that's the way they have it now.
Exactly.
It used to be hilarious. It was a pretty cool look. Just the visor over the forehead.
Making it really tough for you to blade, but, you know, a lot less safe in the eye protection. Giancarlo Bauman writes in from Madison, Wisconsin. So, if so, with the visors, should we make it clear that despite his last name, Geordi LaForge from Star Trek The Next Generation is not French-Canadian? Yes. He has a mandatory visor at all times, except for in the movies. Clearly, we should make everybody know that Geordi LaForge, not a French-Canadian, despite the mandatory visor.
Hey,
joining us down the line, Jeff Merrick, is a man who's a big deal.
He is. He is the president of business operations for the defending Stanley Cup champion Los Angeles Kings. He is Hall of Famer. He is one of the best left wingers the game has ever seen. He is Luke Robitaille. He joins us now. Luke, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing well, and I am French-Canadian.
Oh,
bonjour,
mon ami. That's the only thing I could give you. That's the only thing I can give you.
Soufflé. Salut, Luke, ça va?
Ça va bien.
I'll just excuse myself. Hey, Luke, so I interviewed Dustin Brown before the season, and I asked him this question. I said, okay, so based on the fact that the Kings finished in the 8th seed last year, that won this juggernaut run, won the cup, do you have the same kind of burning desire to try to finish atop of the conference? Or are you in the back of your minds, are you saying to yourselves, well, we could finish in the 8th seed and still win the cup. We know this now. And he was kind of on the fence about it. Do you think part of the reason the Kings came out of the gate a little bit slow is because they kind of know that even though, no matter where they finish in the conference, they'll have a shot at the cup in the playoffs?
God, I hope. Are you serious? He was on the fence. I'm gonna go have a talk with him. No, I think we understand one thing about the NHL as a whole, and definitely our conference even more because we play those guys more. Is we understand you have to get in the playoffs, you know, and we know whoever gets in the playoffs in our conference has a chance at winning the Stanley Cup. And it usually comes down to injuries and so forth. I mean, for sure, as a team and an organization, if we have the opportunity to start at home, we would prefer to play at home because our record at home is obviously better than most teams. But, you know, I think last year we played so well on the road, we played so well as a team in the playoffs that our guys at least have confidence that no matter what happens. Usually, you know, winning the playoffs or getting in the playoffs right now in the NHL, it comes down to injuries. If you don't have too many injuries and your key guys are playing the way they're supposed to play, usually you make the playoffs or you get in.
You know, you've been part of some outstanding teams yourself when you were a player, and then as a member of the executive with the Los Angeles Kings. Last year's playoff performance was clearly one for the ages. How would you compare last year's Los Angeles Kings team to some of the great teams you played for in your past?
I mean, you know, in 93 we had a great team and we won a lot of road games in the same way we ended up losing in the final. Then when I was with Detroit, we certainly had an unbelievable team. But, to see the way our team last year played in the playoffs and the way, like, every game you watch, every game day in and day out, I don't think there was one game throughout the playoffs where we would sit after the game and you rate the players, like Dean and the coach will rate the players. And I don't think you could ever say this guy needs to pick up his game, whether he scored or had points, or it seems like every one of our guys were playing at their peak at the right time, mm-hmm. which is very rare it happened. And that's why we ended up with a record of 16-4.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing run. Being part of this power structure, being there with Dean, what do you think it meant to him and the other guys in player personnel? Because this was a meticulously constructed team for a while, and then they got bold. You know, they went and make the Jeff Carter trade and everything. It seems like they got to be able to kick back and say that our scheme for this team, our plan for this team was validated.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Dean came in and had a lot of patience. And he always reminded everyone that you had to build it from within and you have to acquire as many great young players you can. And at some point, we might need to add or to make the right move to add to those great young players. And then last year when the team actually, it's kind of funny because the team wasn't playing really well, but then yet there were us internally, we had a lot of expectations on our team. You know, I'm not sure the world of hockey had that many high expectations on us, but we did. So when he went out and made the trade for Jeff Carter, and obviously bringing up the kid Nolan and King made all the difference in the world. We became a bigger, faster team right away. But the fact that we added Jeff Carter kind of stabilized our top two lines, and then everybody suddenly understood and knew their roles, and that's how we became a team fairly quickly. And, you know, it was pretty amazing. But it's been fun to see those young guys like Kopitar and Brown, you know, being here, this is their team, and kind of see him grow up with us.
Carter's been amazing, and he's got 15 goals on the season, candidate for the Cy Young, 15 goals
and two assists. When the puck is on his stick, dots down, you know where it's going. It's the back of the net. And you, Luke, yourself scored almost 700 goals regular season in the National Hockey League. When you look at Jeff Carter and you look at his shot, when you look at his release, what comes to Luke Robitaille's mind?
Well, he's got one of those releases that he can let it go at any time, even when he's off balance, which is really, really hard for a goalie. He's obviously, everybody knows he's got an amazing wrist shot, but it's the way he releases it. It's so quick, and he doesn't waste any time on his stick. Plus, he's got a knack to get open, to find a hole, and that's something, you know, you can learn only if you're willing to learn as a young player. But he's certainly got a little bit more that a lot of you know, players don't seem to have, that knack. And sometimes the difference is 6 inches on the ice, you know, where you're just off enough from the defenseman's stick to find that hole to shoot. And he's been you know, incredible. I mean, even when he doesn't score, he'll still get 4 or 5 scoring chances a night. I mean, right now he's hot and things are going for him. But what makes him special to me is he creates on his own 4 or 5 scoring chances a game.
You were there, obviously, not only there, but the leading scorer of the 92-93 Kings team, and have been with the organization for so long. Can you compare the vibe, fan-wise, community-wise, reaction-wise, back during the Gretzky years to what you guys have experienced now that you have a Stanley Cup?
I mean, it's become a lot of the same. Even this year, we're seeing like a huge, you know, influx of new fans, and I guess you could say, I mean, this is LA, so the Hollywood crowd is supporting us, and you know, it's just this town. I always joke with people. People think it's a basketball town. I said, well, for years, if you would have attended a Clippers game, you would have never said it's a basketball town, you know. And then they try to tell me it's a football town. Meanwhile, we had 2 football teams. They left the town because they couldn't draw, you know, at the time. So it's a winning town, and you got to win in this town because there's a lot to do. But when you win in this town, it's absolutely incredible. And for us, the Kings, we've had our hard followings of very passionate fans for years, even when we didn't have any success. And now you add the new fans that are coming in and feeling the experience that our fans are bringing to them, and it's something very special right now that's going on in LA, where, like, you know, those young guys are the talk of the town, and it's a lot of fun.
Hey, Luke, describe what a normal business day is for you. Luke Robitaille wakes up in the morning, and he does what throughout the day?
Well, for us, it's like, you know, I mean, when you're on the business side, you're always trying to get ready for what you're doing next year and so forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're very aware of everything we do in-game and making sure, like, we have a lot of communication with our season seat holders. We're constantly trying to improve our business. I mean, we're going from, on the corporate sponsorship, as an example, we're going from years ago, I think we had 35 partners. We're roughly close to 80, and we're trying to get to the 100 and above in partners. We've doubled our season seat base. You know, our TV ratings are double. So we're constantly trying to improve what we can do as an organization. So coming in, it's one meeting after another, meeting with our staff. You know, we have roughly 100 people on our staff, you know, whether it's the game entertainment, the TV, like I said, radio, and it just seems like it's nonstop, one meeting after another.
You know, I'm always curious about this dynamic, too, between, you know, the business side and the hockey operations side as it relates to the thermometer in the rink. You know, hockey, you know, the coach and the players, they want the rink to be cold because they want the ice to be hard and they want the ice to be fast. Where the business side, you know, when we have people paying a lot of money for these tickets, we would like the place to be, you know, warm inside and comfortable. How much of a battle is that between the business side and the hockey operations side over how warm or how cold the building is?
It's a great organic discussion at all time, but I think the fact that I was a player and I totally know how players think and what they say in the locker room, it's an advantage because I never forgot, you know, how I felt as a player. But the good thing about things like the temperature of the arena now, it's a league rule. So they expect you to have it at a certain temperature before the game. And so we kind of use that as an excuse. But it does get cold. I mean, the building gets warm as it fills up, you know, but there's definitely issues. It's more issues, like for us, it's about player appearances and the way we treat them and so forth. And because I was a player, I understand their time is hard to come by because, you know, you have so many games and lack of sleep and practices and so forth. And I think sometimes people forget how much it takes on your body. And they think when it's a day off, the players can just do things for the organization. It's a lot harder than what people would expect.
Hey, Luke, I don't know if you want to answer this as a former player or as a proxy for the Los Angeles Kings, but your thoughts on realignment. Obviously, geography kind of fits better with the team that's moving to the new divisions. Travel kind of adjusted a little bit for some teams. Playoff format kind of gets a little funky under the proposal. What's your thoughts on realignment?
Yeah, I think on the realignment, it's definitely for the West Coast team, it's a little bit more fair because you don't have to maybe fly to Detroit as often or Columbus as often as what we've had to. It's probably really fair for Detroit and Columbus. And, you know, for them, suddenly their traveling schedule would change tremendously. You know, so we don't mind it. We think it's probably going to advantage, even though for us, we're going to have to fly to Canada a lot more than we've had in the last few years. What makes a big difference when you have to go through custom, you can add an hour to your travel time, especially on the way back, you know, and because we come back at night most of the time, you know, so that changes everything. But we're okay with it. I think that the playoff format, I'm a big believer in giving teams a chance. You don't want it to be where if one division is stronger than the other one, I mean, you don't have a chance. I don't think it's fair. So I kind of like that a little bit. I wouldn't even mind seeing in the future getting it to what I had heard in the past where there'd be a few more teams making the playoffs and it'd be like some kind of mini 2-on-3 before the next 4 out of 7s would start, because it just gives a chance for everyone, you know, maybe an extra 3 or 4 teams to get in, and you know, it just makes it a lot of fun for the fans.
You know, I always love draft stories of players that have gone through the NHL. In Los Angeles, we go back to 2010, and you guys hosted the Taylor Tyler draft in the NHL. Take us back to your draft year, though, 1984. I mean, you went very late. You were a high scorer in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, but you didn't go till the 9th round. Take us back to your draft day story back in 84.
It was a long day for me. That's the year Mario told Pittsburgh if he wasn't signed, he wouldn't go up front. And
that's
somehow
right.
I think the NHL and Pittsburgh didn't believe him. So they named him, and he sat back down. And I can't remember exactly. It seemed like it was an hour for me, but it wasn't. You know, it was probably 15 minutes. They had a break. They didn't know what to do. So that right away, that extended the whole day, and it changed the whole vibe of the draft. And I think the draft, started at either noon or 1 o'clock. I can't quite remember. And my name came out around 7 p.m. that night. And but I do remember at the time that I didn't care. I was just so happy my name was on the list. And I knew from that point on it was up to me to do something about it, you know.
Luke, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. I feel it's actually my duty to ask you this question. The year was 1995. The actor was Jean-Claude Van Damme. Your recollection, sir, of being in the film Sudden Death, and not only that, unleashing one of the great lines in the film in French, in which he asks you, how are you going to do tonight? And you respond in French, we're going to F them up. Really one of the best moments of the film. Your thoughts in being in Die Hard in a hockey arena?
You know, that if you go back, though, it's a true story, and I saved the city of Pittsburgh by scoring before the overtime. No, it was fun. I mean, it was Howard Baldwin's movie at the time, and I remember I'd just gotten to Pittsburgh, and he asked me to do it. I'm like, I can't do this. I just got here, you know, because it was in the summer, and I did it to him as a favor, and let's just say after this, I knew my limits, and I go, that's one thing I know I can never do.
Oh, please, know your limits. You were just on How I Met Your Mother. You're like celebrity.
Every once in a while, I'll do a favor for a friend, but I know my limits. Trust me. You have to know what you can and can't do in this world, and that whole world of acting for me. As long as they keep everything really short, and I'm myself, I'm okay with it. But anything else that I have to remember lines, it's a struggle.
Oh, that's awesome. Hey, Luke, last question for me. And I've, you know what, Luke? I've always wanted to ask you this question. And for every couple times that we've spoken, I've never asked you this one, so I'm going to ask you now. The one thing that's always intrigued me about Luke Robitaille, most players make a choice. They have black tape on their sticks or they have white tape on their sticks. But Luke Robitaille, in the first period and third period of every game, wore white tape on his stick, but in the second period, always had black tape. Luke, why?
You know, it's funny. Not a lot of people notice that. You're one of the few. I was a midget AAA, and that was the first year where they were giving us the tape in my career. And that one game, I always liked white tape on my stick. And one game, the trainer, I think, didn't have the white tape in the second period. And there was a player in those days. His name was Guy Rouleau. And he was a scorer, and he always taped his stick every period. You know, and when you were a kid, you never taped it every period. But that year was the first time we had free tape, and he would tape his stick every period. And I was like, wow, like this guy, that's amazing. He's doing this. So I started doing it. And then one game during that year, there was something where we ran out of tape after the first period, or the trainer didn't have it, so he only had black. So I taped it black, and it worked. You know, I can't remember. I think I got a couple goals. And for the rest of my career, I just – and then in the third period, I had black that game – white, sorry. And then for the rest of my career, I just stuck with it. I mean, I think there's not one game I did any different for my entire career. Just
so would it – So you would retape every intermission, or would you have two different sticks? You have one.
No, I would retape every intermission.
You would retape. That, Luke Robitaille, may be the geekiest hockey question I've ever asked, and thank you for having a great
Wait,
answer for it.
That's the first time ever that someone actually asked me the question.
Wow.
Oh, you know what? I've always wondered it, man. I've always, like, why is Robitaille have, I'm a equipment geeky kind of guy, and so I've always noticed, like, why does Robitaille have black tape in the second
And there was something inside me, you know, sometimes I started, you know, you make your own belief into when you have success or not, you know, and there was something inside of me, like some games when you'd have the puck a lot around the net, just figure maybe the goalie doesn't remember, because they only see sometimes the puck right around, he might not know that it was me with a black tape, you know. I started believing all this stuff. I made my own belief. Whatever works, I guess.
Hey, worked out great for you, man. You got in the Hall of Fame. Take a bow.
There you go. All right, Luke Robitaille, thank you so much for joining us here on the America vs. Wyshynski podcast. Continued success
for
the Los Angeles Kings, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Luke.
Thank you, guys. Great talking to you.
Bon chance, mon ami.
I understand that in the third period, you used to put your belt on the second loop, and the first period, it was on the third loop. Is there any reason for that? Or
Okay, hang on. Okay, like, I've got a batch of these questions, like, for various people around the NHL that I want to ask, and that's always been the question I've wanted to ask Luke Robitaille, but I've never had the chance to ask him. So I'm sorry. When I get a chance to ask, as geeky as it is, and as selfish a question, I don't know if anyone listening gives two flying F's about what color tape Luke Robitaille used on his stick, but for whatever reason, I've been fascinated by this phenomenon all through Luke Robitaille's career. So thanks to Luke Robitaille and thanks to this podcast for giving me the venue to ask my goofy, stupid, dumb little hockey question.
My only regret for that interview is that we didn't mention this during the interview, but he is, of course, a random penguin.
Kills he me. Is indeed a random penguin. Thank you.
So terrible.
No, yes.
Terrible.
We should have introduced him as a random penguin. Also, you know, director of business affairs, Los Angeles Kings, Stanley Cup champion, hockey.
That's his legacy. His legacy
NHL,
is
blah, blah, blah.
A random penguin. Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you like that Powered Baldwin thing? It's like you come to the Penguins, and the first thing you hear is, oh, by the way, you have to be in my movie.
You're going to be in a movie. Like, a lot of guys, and this is sort of highlighted in the movie Slapshot, when you sign on with a team, like, they make you do, like, the goofy fashion show. There's a lot of meet and greets that you don't want to do, but because you're part of the team and it's in your contract for X number of appearances a month, you end up doing it. But I don't know how many people that signed up for doing a movie. Yeah, welcome to Pittsburgh Penguins. Here's your script. My script? That's you in there, page 35. as opposed to at 7 in the morning.
As opposed to when you sign with the Devils and you get, welcome to the Devils, here's your script. My script? Yeah, what you'll be telling the media for the next 7 years of your contract. Or else.
Right. And what length your hair will be and our policy on mustaches and beards.
Here are things you won't be doing. Going on dates. Going to car dealerships for signings.
Here's what you will be doing after the game. Going to your hotel room to read.
Playing more than 10 feet in front of Marty in the defensive zone.
That's right. We collapse around the net. Two on one, the pass doesn't get through. You understand that? Marty takes the shot. The pass doesn't get through.
Not griping when I take over the coaching duties with 10 games left.
That's right. And if Marty wants a new coach, then damn it, Marty gets a new coach.
Oh, Hedberg again last night, huh? Jesus Christ.
He got the hook. Hey, I'll tell you what, though. When you look at Keith Kincaid, and he just got sent down today. I mentioned this on Twitter last night. Dude stopped Steven Stamkos on a breakaway. If Keith Kincaid does nothing else in the history of his career, he will always have a story to tell his children and his grandchildren. I stopped Steven Stamkos on a breakaway. It's the first thing I thought of when I saw that.
He can also tell his grandchildren that he has the name of a cheap James Bond knockoff from the 1970s. Kincaid in Danger Squad. Or whatever the hell.
Yeah, again, you're right. You know what? It was an interesting day yesterday when you consider what happened at night and then what was said on the podcast earlier as I defended Steve Mason. Oops. Wrong day to do that.
All right.
And
so,
as you blasted Johan Hedberg, and yep, right day to do that.
There were many great performances, though, last night that were the antithesis of the crap-the-bed performances by Steve Mason and Johan Hedberg. One of them was by the Washington Capitals last night. The Capitals rallied from three down against the Bruins, win in overtime in a brilliant, brilliant move by Eric Fair. The Capitals have 19 points in 21 games. The New York Rangers have 24 points in 21 games. The Devils, 25 and 23. The division leader in the Southeast, Carolina, 27 and 22. Do you think the Capitals can make the push, make the playoffs, despite their disastrous start to this season?
If they, I was saying this yesterday at Sportsnet, I was watching with Brian Lawton and before the show, and was saying if they, because they went down, was it 3-0 to the Boston Bruins?
Mm-hmm.
Was it 3? And then they started to come back. We're like,
yeah,
man. If they lose this game to Boston at home, that's the game we'll point to where the Washington Capitals officially lost the season. And I kind of got that feeling all throughout the game that if they lose this thing, and when you look at what happened in the second and then third and then the extra frame, isn't it almost as if, you know, Adam Oates went in there in the first intermission and said, guys, if we lose this one, this is our season. This is it. This puts us, you know, 17, stay at 17 points, last in the conference, have to climb over Florida, Buffalo, Tampa Bay, Winnipeg, the Islanders, the Philadelphia Flyers to get in the playoff picture. Because don't just, as we've seen, post-first lockout, you don't just look at the points. You look at the teams you have to leap over. And it's all three-point games because everybody's in the conference. There's no crossover. Oh, sure, they won, but the team that they played isn't in our conference. So there's no extra point getting into the system. Yes, there is. So if they would have lost yesterday, Wish, I would have said, yeah, that's it for the Washington Capitals. That's too much. But I still think now they have a flicker of hope.
Here's
how did you feel about it?
I thought their effort for the last 2 weeks has been great. I thought last night was revelatory in the way that they played in that game. I mean, just really, really played well and getting big goals out of guys, the supporting cast that they've been waiting for to kind of step forward when the stars don't do their job. So I thought it was great. And I think the primary pivot for this team in being able to kind of turn the corner, the 7-3 in your last 10, Braden Holtby. I mean, Holtby started off the season terrible because he had the weight of that of the expectations on his back. Obviously also was thinking about a contract that was finally settled during the season. Once we got past that point, he's been one of the better goalies in this league in the last couple weeks for the Capitals. So competent goaltending plus a, as Adam Oates has said, about 70 to 75% on learning and understanding and being instinctual about his system, they're starting to come around. Now, that said, you get past this week, you get to March 14th, now you're talking at Carolina, at Boston, versus Buffalo, at Pittsburgh, back-to-back at Winnipeg, which ain't an easy place to play, even though they did pretty well there, and then at the Rangers. So we'll learn a bit more about this team in that stretch, because right now they're 3-6-1 on the road. They go six games on the road and one at home after that Carolina game next Tuesday. So I think we'll understand a little bit more about the Capitals then.
Okay, Smarty Pants. You think I'm a pretty geeky guy for asking the hockey tape question to Luke Robitaille?
Uh-huh.
Our good friend and sharp eyeball, as it turns out, Karen Douglas, speaking of the Washington Capitals, submits Adam Oates used white tape in warm-up, black tape in the game. I know that, so I care about the tape story. Thank you, Karen Douglas.
Wow. It's an entire subculture of hockey fandom that's been obsessed with hockey tape, and now you've become their Moses.
Their Pied Piper. Yeah, I'm their Pied Piper now.
All right, it's time now for a Wednesday favorite here on the America vs. Wyszynski podcast. It is in which Jeff and Greg go postal.
You want to do a mailbag segment every week?
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyszynski. Whoa, not that deep.
We are nutting up for each other here.
Now's your chance to ask Merrick and Wyszynski anything, and we mean anything.
You got your thinking, Took?
Vegan cooking tips. Favorite Doctor Who characters. What's the best bar in Stouffville? Is there a bar in Stouffville? The meaning of life. Wait, let's not get carried away with that.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyszynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyszynski.
Ryan Thomas writes in, if you guys had to pick one booze of choice to drink for the rest of your life, what would beer liquor brand would you choose and why? I myself would choose Belvedere Vodka and have no issue with it. Booze, Macallan's, any of the of your vintages. Yeah. Beer, you know, it's funny, like, the punking ale from Southern Tier is my favorite beer, I'd have to say. Like, that's why I clamor for it whenever it gets released. But I don't think I could drink a pumpkin beer for the perpetuity of my life. So that said, I don't know, man. Like, the beer is a tricky thing because I'm a man of many tastes. I guess my answer would be if for the rest of my life I could be followed around by a true Irishman who knew how to pour a proper Guinness, it would maybe be that.
Yeah, maybe a Guinness. Okay, so what are my options here? Because the ultimate
booze or beer. Or beer, either of the two.
Because I'm a wine guy. I like a glass of wine. Bonterra Cabernet's been my favorite of recent note. But booze, it would have to be an 18-year-old Glenlivet.
Oh, nice.
Simple malt scotch. Oh, yeah. Neat, eh? I don't mess around with the cubes or nothing. Nice.
No,
two,
neat.
3 fingers of scotch. Yeah, nice, neat scotch.
Cute.
But beer, I always change. Like in the summer, like just for like a sipper out in the backyard, I'll drink a Tecate. Last night when I got home from Hockey Central, I had a delicious bottle of, I don't think you've ever tried it, from the King, it's a microbrewery here, north of the city called King. I had a King, a Pilsner, a Royal Pilsner, last night, and that was delicious. Beer's a tough one, because it always changes sort of seasonally for me.
Yeah,
so I
agree.
What I like to have in the winter is not what I'm going to have in the summer.
Totally. That's exactly right. And I would, you're right, because I would also say that, you know, my favorite like summer drinking beer, or maybe like fall drinking beer is Scheinerbach because there is something spiritual about it being a beautiful night and you're kicking back with a Shiner and it feels like it transports me back to hanging out in Austin, Texas, which is one of my favorite places. By the way, if any of our listeners in the UK can somehow direct your boy on how to smuggle in the Colonel from the Colonel Brewery in London.
The Colonel?
Because I fell in love with all of their beer. It got to the point, Merrick, where I was going into places specifically looking to see if they had it on tap or in a bottle, and if they didn't, I'd leave the place. The Colonel was amazing. We can't get it here. So Londoners or UKers or whomever, Tom Manningham pretty much, who I'm talking to, one of our favorites from the UK, find me a way to get the Colonel. Like, put it in a box and label it like teddy bears, and then send it to me. Is pretty much what I'm asking.
Clink, clink, clink. Why are these teddy bears clinking?
they're metallic.
Last time I was there was Spitfire Ale when I was in London. It's called a Kentish Ale. Actually, thankfully, we can get it here at the LCBO, so I can still. Did I give you a Spitfire when you were here last time? I gave you the pumpkin beer. I don't know if I gave you the Spitfire Kentish Ale.
All kind of hazy. All kind of hazy.
We were deep into the pores that night. That's true.
Good times. Good times. Elaine O. writes in, sort of a two-part question. Of all the people you've met and talked to in the hockey world, who gives the best interview? And corollary to that, who tells the best stories, is the best conversationalist off the record? I'll go both Washington Capitals on this one because just based on my experiences. Three guys in the Caps locker room that I love talking to. Brouwer, mostly post-game because he's honest. Brooks Like, again, mostly post-game because he's honest. Carl Alsner, because he is random and wonderful and will talk to you about any subject and is not cliche about it and is great to talk to. Who tells the best stories, is the best conversationalist off the record? Again, I'll go cap-centric, Alan May. Alan May, who I want to say we've had on this podcast before, is without question what I would call the green room guy. And Merrick knows what I'm talking about. You sit in the green room with Alan May before a television broadcast, and you hear stories that make your effing head spin. You can't even wrap your brain around some of the shit that this guy has experienced and seen and knows about the National Hockey League. And his insight is incredible, and his stories are incredible. And then you get on the air, and you get about 70% of that, maybe 65. Yeah. And that's fine, because you can't speak out of turn when it comes to the shit that you know. You've got to be... You know, you don't want to go on the air and you know, blow out relationships or tell stories at a turn, or whatever. But in the green room with Alan May is some of my favorite time in the world because that man can spin a yarn. Let me tell you,
can tell a story. Yeah. From the guys that are in the league right now. Oh, you know who's a great interview? Chad LaRose of the Carolina Hurricanes.
Yeah.
Chad LaRose is a really good interview. I'll throw Chad LaRose into that mix. I always love talking to, and this is the thing about this guy. When he played, he's no different than what he is now. But even when he played, and specifically when the new rules package came in, he was one of the most outspoken guys against it and how he didn't like the way the game was progressing, and that was Bobby Holík.
Mm.
When Holík played in the NHL,
right?
It was like no filter. No filter, right from his heart. That was Bobby Holík. He was grand. As far as telling the best stories, I mean, I've had a few guys in my life that I've, could just sit and listen to stories all day. But, and maybe it's because I worked with him for 5 years. And, you know, pre-show, after the show, out for a beer, Bill Waters, who was an agent and assistant general manager, a broadcaster, an analyst, who saw pretty much everything starting in the mid to late 60s all the way up to the present, really, and has some incredible and hilarious all off the record stories about how the league has been run, the people that were involved in it, and what they did do over the course of their careers. No one tells a better story than Bill Waters. Although, you know who's really good too, that I've gotten to know working in sports and over the past year? Doug McClain tells great stories.
Yeah.
And if you're ever, and I can never tell it on the air, but if you're ever like at a, a tweet up, or ever like a party, and you pull me aside, say, Jeff, tell me the Sean Connery story. That's all you have to say. You know that one?
I do, yeah. You did tell me that one, actually.
Tell me the Sean Connery story.
That's a brilliant story.
Oh, God, yeah. It made me want to, Doug McClain to me can tell a story like, and he's got that, you know, the Charlottetown PEI sort of sound to his voice too. It's great, great voice. And he tells, so Bill Waters and Doug McClain, those are the two guys for me that tell some great stories.
On the serious tip, this is from Matt in Calgary. I wanted to know what your thoughts are on the way contracts are structured in the NHL. Do you like them that way? Do you like them the way they are, or would you prefer to see them handled like the NFL? I like the idea of restructuring a contract, Brady's recent contract, or getting cut if you don't perform instead of coasting due to guaranteed money. So essentially, it's a guaranteed money question as far as the NHL.
I think when you consider how players hide injuries, specifically concussions, so they can stay in the lineups, they can still earn their money. I think if you take away guaranteed contracts, I think a lot of players are going to start hiding significant injuries to their detriment. See, I see guaranteed contracts as a player safety issue. The fact that they have guaranteed contracts means they can properly take time to heal, and specifically something as significant as their brain. I think if you start taking away guaranteed contracts, you have a lot of players lying to stay in the lineup so they can still earn their money and they can still earn their contracts. To me, it's a player safety issue more than anything else. I'm not sure where you're at it, Wish.
I see your point. I would use the second part of Matt's statement at the end of that question, or getting cut if you don't perform instead of coasting due to guaranteed money. We've all seen this on every team, no matter where your loyalties lie. We've all seen guys sign big time contracts. Maybe they were singing for their supper in the season before signing that contract and wound up getting a big deal, and then they're not the same player after that. So I in the spirit of increasing player transactions, in the spirit of trying to make things like the frenzy and the deadline a little bit more exciting, I do like the idea of there being a way for teams to cut players easier, but then that also kind of does dip into the guaranteed money issue, which is that these guys play a sport in which you want them to make all the coin they can and not have anyone take it away from them, considering they put their well-being on the line every night out there, especially those assholes that don't wear visors. still scoring points. The debate's done for like an hour, and I'm still scoring points.
You think we're summing up? No, we're still adding up. That's what happens here on the podcast. It's never.
This is a great one from John in Chicago. What would be on your goalie mask, and what would the pad color scheme be? I assume Greg is playing for the New Jersey and Jeff is playing for some team from the 1930s in a town I never heard of. Love the show. Keep up the amazing work. John from Chicago.
Well, it would be the Kenora Thistles and the Penticton Vs.
Here's what I do. I've long thought this, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. The color, because it brought up the Seattle Easter eggs. I would go with like a Hart Foundation pink and black or a pink and baby blue setup. Like, I don't want to put a bunch of characters and stuff in my mask. I want to come up with a color scheme that is so shockingly unique. Then that's my signature. Not necessarily that I've got a, cartoon of Star Wars on my mask. No, I want a color scheme that is all shock and awe, preferably pink, and especially pink because then it's like an adorable Adrian Adonis thing, Merrick. Then it becomes you're a real tough guy, but you're dressed up in foofiness, and you sneak up on people with how nasty you can be. So I would play like Billy Smith, but I would dress like Adrian Adonis.
I love that. That's almost like a Playboy Buddy Rose kind of vibe, too, for all your old-school wrestling fans. You know what I always loved? I don't think I've ever mentioned this in the podcast. My favorite masks that I've ever seen is one of recent note, and it's Curtis Sanford, who is from Owen Sound. And so what he had on his mask were painted the two of the more famous people in the history of the Ontario town of Owen Sound. One was Billy Bishop, who was a World War I fighter hero in Canada, and the other was former NHL netminder Harry Lumley. And that's so it was a tribute to his hometown that he had on his mask. So if it were my mask, it would be a tribute to the hockey players that have gone through Stouffville. And that would be exactly three who made it to the NHL. So on my mask would be, how random would this be, Wish? A picture of Brad May, a picture of Keith Acton, and a picture of Michael Delzato. That would be on my mask. How about that, Troika? Mayday, Woody, and Delzato. Those would be the guys on my mask as a tribute to my new hometown of Stouffville.
And then on the back, a picture of the only bar in Stouffville, right?
That's there are more bars. Just because I only go to one is no reason to... Well, hey man, how many are there? One, two, three, four. I think there's five.
You can count the bars in your town on one hand.
It's a small town, dude.
Jonathan Cable writes in a question that is open for debate. Which would be more difficult, Greg Wyshynski going vegan for an entire year or Jeff Merrick taking on Wyshynski's carnivorous diet for a week? For a week? Oh, come on. What? Week versus year?
I couldn't do it.
Wait, hold on a second. You couldn't eat meat for a week?
No. I think my body would reject it at this point.
Wow.
Yeah. I couldn't even do it for a day. I couldn't even do it for a meal. Wish would win that.
I could go vegetarian for a year. If I had to, I could go vegetarian for a year.
Of course you could.
Yeah.
Totally. Your heart kicks out and you have like a triple bypass and your doctor says, okay, that's it for you and meat. You could totally do it because your life is on the line.
Well, that's motivation. I think he's talking about a personal choice versus if another piece of cow passes through your lips, your heart will explode. If I needed to make a if I need for whatever reason, let's say there's a gypsy curse on me or something,
I
have to lift it by eating vegan
away.
For a year, I could totally do it. Now, wait, vegan
you
is that means could I have pizza when I'm a vegan?
Yeah, there just can't be any dairy products on it or meat products on it.
Oh, dairy? Vegan is dairy
yes,
too.
Vegan. Yeah, bro.
For fuck's sake.
I told you, man. I'm hardcore.
So wait a second. So that means I couldn't have cheese.
Correct.
Oh, this is getting tougher.
Well, you can just say vegetarian then. You could be like Miracle.
You see,
when I first read
Cable's query, I thought it said vegetarian. I'm like, I could do it's vegetarian. Like, shit, man.
I could
eat plain pizza all the time.
Cheese? That's awesome.
But he's taking cheese off the table. Oh, shit.
Yeah, hang on a second.
I think it was a whole different issue.
That's a line right there.
There a line has been crossed.
The Greg Wyszynski cheese line. Paz, that's your line in the sand in cheese, in string cheese.
But you couldn't do it for a week.
Couldn't do it for a meal. I couldn't even do a single meal.
Wow.
No.
Man.
No, could not do
Saints
it.
Alive.
I've had my last, bud.
All right.
Yeah. I've had my last. Trust me.
That's understandable. It's understandable.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
Let's go here. This is another food one from Michael O.
A lot of food questions on our podcast. I like that.
I was on vacation last week, and in between many libations, I finally had to find a suitable meal to keep me going. Being that I was at a hockey game, I naturally gravitated towards the saltiest snack available. As someone who doesn't eat pork and rarely eats red meat, I decided to junk it up as much as possible while sticking to my absurd food code. When I returned to my seat, my lady friend just stared as I dipped a veggie dog into nacho cheese. She gave me a horrified but intriguing look and asked me what I was eating. Naturally, in my semi-inebriated state, I responded, I got the depressed Jeff Merrick special. My question for you two is, what would be the deli menu sandwich meal named after you? That's fantastic.
The depressed Jeff Merrick special.
I'll tell you what mine would be, okay? Because I would want to bridge it. I would want to bridge the two geographic locations that I've spent the most time in. So, although I've been in Virginia now for a bit, I also was in Maryland for a bit, and I'll go just Chesapeake area, and then also I grew up in New Jersey. So, to bridge those two areas, it would be a delicious Kaiser roll, right?
Yeah.
The base of the thing, the burger of the thing, if you will, would be a crab cake, like a Baltimorean crab cake to represent the Chesapeake area. On top of the crab cake would be Taylor ham from Jersey. So that would be the crux of the sandwich. You could dress it up with all kinds of condiment, whatever, but that would be the basis of the sandwich. It'd be a crab cake with Taylor ham sandwich, and it would be called the Wyszynski.
For me, it would have to be, I don't like too much bread with a sandwich, so it probably just have to be a wrap. Be a wrap with like spicy hummus, either like a really strong hot curry sauce or ghost pepper hot sauce, strips of probably sesame tempeh on it, and then on top of all of that, I would put vinegar-based coleslaw.
Oof.
Wrap that sucker up. Wrap that sucker up, and I'm chowing it down. Yeah.
Nice.
Coleslaw on the sandwich, bro, for sure.
Boy, you've done well, sir.
Thanks, bud.
So there's Going Postal. Just revisiting now the visor issue for a little bit here, because we're getting a lot of people to chime in on visors as well. A lot of people that want to see it mandatory, a lot of people that don't. Mike Baddock writes in, visors should not be mandatory in the NHL. They limit the capabilities of sight for some players, much like how helmets are rarely cumbersome and limit players' ability to swivel their heads and shouldn't be mandatory, much like how seatbelts can be uncomfortable and shouldn't be required while driving. The sarcasm is obvious here. So it's like seatbelts, sir.
Okay.
No?
Yeah, sure.
Matthew McGreevy, visors should be optional for the players. If GMs want to protect their assets, they should put a stipulation about wearing a visor in the players' contracts. Now that's
interesting. Hang on. If you're worried about player safety, then why not full cages?
Well, yeah.
How about full cages for everyone that comes out of U.S. college hockey? Because the argument has always been, well, they have visors in junior. Well, they have cages in Div 1. Everybody coming out of the Div 1 programs, you're wearing a full cage.
Oh, man. That'd be great because that means
you don't
US...
want
what?
Broken jaws. You don't want broken noses. And you know what? Here's another danger, too, with visors is sticks getting caught underneath the visor. Like asking any player, they'd rather have a stick bounce off their face than a stick get caught in the visor and have a guy yank it out, maybe carve out their eyeball in the process. So if you're going to say, oh, mandatory visors, why don't you say mandatory cages to prevent that from happening?
Yeah.
That is the next step, isn't it?
The beautiful part about that, though, is that if you go mandatory cages for all U.S. college players, that means U.S. college players could be the biggest dicks imaginable in the NHL and start crap all over the ice.
Go ahead. Punch me, tough guy. You want to drop your gloves to fight? Okay, hit this.
Tough guy.
So Caps 37, Nicole Thornton makes the same point, which is that the email made, which is, I'm surprised teams don't force players to wear them to protect their investment. I think it's stupid not to. I know they can't, but should they? I mean, should there be, much like we goofed on Lou before about cutting your hair a certain way, like, should that be, should teams have the leeway to say, if you play for us, you are our investment, and you must wear this visor in order to, so we can protect our investment?
Anything involving the game, whether it is rules of the game, whether it's dimensions of the rink, whether it is equipment, all has to be collectively bargained between the NHL and the Players Association. So it's not a matter of, well, here, you know, we wear these suits to the game.
Well,
that's just a matter of protocol. But anything involving the game itself.
And what I say to you, sir,
is collectively bargained.
Send it back to the states, as we do here in the United States with the Congress and some. Send it back to the states and allow them to handle their own problems.
And that's why I was kind of surprised the Players Association didn't put up more of a stink about the Sean Avery rule. Or, sorry, the massaging of the rule that apparently already existed when Avery did his routine in front of Marty Brodeur.
The way they just
snuck that rule in. It's dumb.
Yeah.
I hated the way they did that. Sean Avery, in one of the more creative moments in the history of the NHL, because it's Sean Avery. It was actually, when you look at it, too, that's a gutsy play. Turning your back to a slap shot. That's balls. In order to screen a goaltender, that's sacrifice. That is sacrifice right there. Can you get a slap shot in the back?
Yeah.
Last time I checked, ain't no protection there, bro. That's gutsy.
No.
That's gutsy.
Shot on Avery's back.
That's Sean Avery, so, yeah.
The last thing we need to talk about here today, obviously, is the tragic passing of the gentleman who portrayed Paul Bearer in World Wrestling Federation and then World Wrestling Entertainment.
Yeah.
What's your recollection of Paul Bearer?
Well, his name is Bill Moody, and I remember when I used to do the live audio wrestling program for like 4 or 5 years. He was always one of my favorite guests because you expect him to come on and talk like this, but he never, like, Bill was a wonderful personality, in the game, and that, you know, as the Undertaker's manager, that's one of those characters that's going to live forever in the history of professional wrestling. But he's also a student of the game. He's also a historian of the game. He's also someone who just loved to talk about wrestling, like everything to do about wrestling, was angles or characters or development or storyline arcs, all of that. He was always one of my favorite guys to talk to. You know, we had one of the going postal questions, who's your favorite guy to talk to, favorite interviewer, and great story. I'd throw Bill Moody right in there. He was one of the great, you know, sort of raconteurs and storytellers of the last generation in pro wrestling.
He was also one of these guys, one of the first guys that I realized, you know, when you're a kid, when I was a kid, I didn't have ready access to all of the wrestling until I got a little bit older. So then all of a sudden you see the NWA stuff. Then all of a sudden you see the other wrestling out there. Then when people go from one organization to the other, you realize the concept of repackaging gimmicks. So it didn't occur to me right when I saw Paul Bearer arrive on the scene that this guy was Percy Pringle III from World Class Wrestling. And it kind of blew my mind, right? So, I had a chance to meet the man last year at the World Wrestling Entertainment Fan Fest before WrestleMania in Miami, and I will never forget it because the way they have it structured is there's like all these different stations that you go to. There's a place you can go see memorabilia, like all the robes and stuff. There's a place where you can do your own entrance. There's places for autographs, gear stores. There's actually a wrestling ring there. They hold matches during the day. It's a really, really cool event when it comes to your town. You should check it out. Way in the back, they had this thing called Undertaker's Graveyard. Undertaker's Graveyard, and what it was all of the wrestlers that the Undertaker had defeated during his record streak at WrestleMania, which, by the way, is now completely threatened by CM Punk. It was all the wrestlers he had defeated. Now, there was a certain macabre aspect of this because many of the wrestlers he had defeated are actually dead now. So to just walk past King Kong Bundy. Is he dead? I don't know. Is it Bundy dead?
No.
Okay. There's some other ones that he died. I don't remember. But the point is that some of them were dead. So there was a certain macabre aspect to it. It was very creepy. A lot of tombstones, a lot of dry ice, very sort of smoky and cool, very dark. Mm-hmm. And way in the back of this graveyard, as you walk through it and see all of the wrestlers that The Undertaker had buried in WrestleMania, way in the back was a rotund gentleman sitting on a chair, on a stage, Paul Bearer.
Awesome.
And I got to tell you, you had the opportunity to meet Roddy Piper, which I did at this thing. You could have stood online and met any number of WWE superstars. There was no more geek out moment for me at WrestleMania than sitting up, standing up there with Paul Bearer and taking the man's photo and doing the Paul Bearer face whilst the photo was being taken.
Do you still have the photo?
I'll try to put it on. It was on my Facebook page. I'll try to tweet it out later.
Tweet that, dude.
I gotta tell you, man. Like, that's the coolest. And the legacy of this man, besides being as Merrick said, you know, just a student of the game and a real ambassador in some ways for wrestling. Because I've heard him interviewed. I think on Arto Cal's show over on the Score at one point. We're always gonna have the voice, the Paul Bearer voice, Undertaker. That thing will always be with us. And the thing about wrestling that made me a wrestling fan was the people that could strike the delicate balance between intensity and quasi-realism and the notion that this is all a carnival act. And I don't know if there was anybody that did it better than Bill Moody. To strike the balance between being a guy that sometimes you felt was generally disturbed and being a guy who obviously was in on the joke. And few people could do it better than him.
And one of the best parts about the story, too, is he was an actual funeral director. Right? I mean, even after he started his professional wrestling career as a manager, he was a funeral director. That's what he got his degree in.
Yeah.
Right? He was a funeral director. And I think he did embalmings as well. So it must have been kind of a trip for him to actually play his career in a WWF ring. With the Undertaker. Indeed. And you know what I like about him too? He got into, anyone who knows me knows I'm a big Paul Heyman fan.
Mark.
Always loved what Paul did. I'm a total Heyman Mark. He got into wrestling the same way Paul Heyman did. He was a photographer as a teenager. Just hanging around, taking photographs. That was his on-ramp to get into this world. He got in as a photographer. And the next thing you know, he became, well, both him and Paul became two of the great managers of the last generation.
Last one on the show, Phil Coker. He's been bugging us for weeks. No love for TNA wrestling? Angle, AJ Styles, Bobby Roode. So much talent, so little appreciation. There are people in TNA that I enjoy. Bobby Roode being one of them. Bobby Roode, by the way, a hockey fan. Want to point that out.
Is he a hockey fan?
Yes, he is. But overall, the product is not necessarily of my liking.
When they focus it, like when they make it all about like guys like Christopher Daniels, I really dig it and give them time to do like long matches. Then I really like it.
Yeah. But it's always A, the old guys had the run of the place, and it became so Hogan centric that it was sort of a turnoff. And B, it always had the stink of a 3-year old WCW cheese, in my opinion.
And that's why you got to get into ROH, bud.
I like ROH. I loved watching it.
And then
all of a sudden, it went off my HD my HD channel. With that, we will mention, by the way, that I haven't seen a fresh episode of this in quite a while. If you're someone on the internet that has never seen Botchamania, please dive down the rabbit hole, kiss your day goodbye, and maybe it's snowing by you. Maybe you're stuck inside.
Yeah. It's like the video equivalent of Hockey DB. You know how you go down that Hockey DB wormhole?
Yep.
You start chasing names. Oh, you play on this team, and you go to that team. And next thing you know, all of a sudden, you're like Boom Boom Jeffrey on in 1955.
I'll go one better for you than Hockey DB. The one for me is Hockey Reference. Hockey Reference is a site where that,
yeah.
Like, because then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I've been looking at all of the people who wore 24 for the for the Philadelphia Flyers. Like, you know, it's just that kind of thing, right?
We were bored yesterday at work, and so, you know, we did just sort of a random topic. I don't know how it arose. Number of players who have ever come from Rhode Island. And sure enough, there we are, end up at Hockey Reference. We're sitting around sports, and somehow Rhode Island came up, and someone said, I wonder how many people have come from Rhode Island. Well, sure enough, Hockey Reference, folks. It ain't just Brian Boucher.
So true. All right, thanks to Luke Robitaille for a really great interview. Love that interview.
Yeah, he was good. And thanks for answering the most esoteric question I've ever asked in my career in media, which goes back to 1994.
Indeed. And thanks again to everybody who participated in Going Postal. and the visor issue. And we'll be back tomorrow for more fun and merriment. Tonight, will the Colorado Avalanche, who I believe have not played the Blackhawks yet, will the Avalanche be the ones to take out the Blackhawks in regulation?
That, well, if you look at, like, say, for example, the Philadelphia Flyers, when they had their 35-game run, it was the Minnesota North Stars that took them out. And you know, Wish, it was a 7-1 game. And they got taken out. It was one of those teams that just sort of shows up out of nowhere. Bang! You didn't expect this. That takes down the winning streak. Now, I'm not saying it's going to happen tonight against the Colorado Avalanche. But it has happened before.
Indeed.
Not necessarily going to be like a power. Not going to be like, Vancouver ends the streak. Anaheim brings the curtain down on the Blackhawks. Hey, man. Might just be the Avs.
Cool.
That's how
Thanks,
I saw
everybody.
It tonight. If I'm the broadcaster, you never know, because it kind of looks like a tilted rink game.
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us on this marathon edition. Going postal always pushes us into marathon territory, and I love it. I love that happens.
It's good times. It's good times.
Thank you, everybody. We will talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you.